I chose a title for this talk that was meant to be a little bit provocative. The first part of the talk you really should think of as a continuation of the discussion that Matthias Troyer started last week. I'm going to try to address some of the questions he raised and hopefully come up with some answers as to how we can do better than what he presented in terms of the numerical calculations. Okay. I'm going to concentrate mostly on the TJ model, and this is standard nearest neighbor TJ model, so there's no T prime. I will enforce the no double occupancy constraint exactly in the calculation. I will make a brief foray into the Hubbard model, and again, this is just very standard Hubbard model. But mostly I'll be considering TJ model physics. The correlator I want to address is the pair correlator, and I'm only going to look at singlet pairs, spin singlet. One thing that is going to be different right away from what typically is done in other calculations is I will not limit the sites I and j to be nearest neighbors. I will let the model tell me how big the pair wave function wants to be. And the way that I did this calculation is through high temperature series expansion. I essentially calculated every possible thing that would exist through 12th order in beta for this 4-point correlator. Now, it'll turn out a lot of this information I'm not going to really use. But when I started this calculation, I wasn't really sure how I was going to analyze the data at the end of it. And since it took a full year of computer time to calculate these various quantities, there was roughly 500,000 separate calculations. I had lots of time to think about how I was going to analyze the data. And it turned out, even after I produced the data, I still needed another year after that to really understand it. Yes, and a sabbatical. So it was not an easy problem. This took a lot of work. Now, another point that is a little bit different than what previous calculations have done is I'm really going to think of this as explicitly a 4-point correlator. So I'm not going to jump immediately to something that's a 2-point correlator, but I will try to derive an effective 2-point correlator from the 4-point correlator. Okay. Now, the first thing you need to do is this 4-point correlator has lots of extra stuff in it. And this extra stuff is all from lower order correlators, in particular products of 2-point correlators. These pieces can't tell you anything about the pair fluctuations. They're 2-point correlators. So one needs to remove these pieces to really be looking at the 4-point fluctuations. Okay? Now, the nice thing about removing these pieces is it gives you a very clean comparison point to non-interacting models. For any non-interacting model, this correlator is identically zero. And that means zero for all fillings, all temperatures, all band structures. It's really just zero. Okay. Now, once I have the cluster calculation done, which is what the series expansion calculation is, I need to embed these things into the real square lattice. And when I do that, I will produce a correlator per site, which will depend on three lengths. And I'll take two of these, the little r's, to be the internal structure of the pairs, and the capital R is a measure of the distance between the two pairs. Now, from this, I'll need to combine this with some symmetry factors, which I haven't mentioned yet, to talk about different symmetry pair wave functions. But once I do that, I will then try to generate an effective 2-point correlator, which depends only on capital R and the symmetry, alpha. And the way I'll measure the strength of the pairing then is through calculation of a correlation length in a very standard way. So the end result of the calculation will be a series for psi squared. And that's what I will really look at in terms of measuring the strength of things. So the big question in all of this is how to calculate the effective 2-point correlator. And one thing that I really would like my 2-point correlator to be is consistent with Ginzburg-Landau. For all of the symmetries I'm going to look at, the representations are one-dimensional. So we have exactly the same sort of Ginzburg-Landau theory we would have for a conventional S-wave superconductor. There's nothing different. And I'm not going to apply a field, so we don't have that complication. I am, however, looking at fluctuations above TC. And from my calculational technique, that's all I can look at. I can't go below TC. The important thing here is that the two-point correlator, when you do the momentum transform, is related to the Ginzburg-Landau order parameter, eta, again, the Fourier component of it. And it's the absolute magnitude squared. So this tells you immediately that P of Q has to be non-negative. And more than that, I would say that it tells you that you don't expect P of Q to depend upon the internal pair phase. The reason for that is, again, once you have the Ginzburg-Landau order parameter, that determines the change in the free energy. And the free energy, for those of you that have done phenomenological calculations of anisotropic order parameters, you know that one of the real problems in identifying the symmetry of things is always that your results only depend upon the magnitude of the order parameter. And as a consequence, you're always looking for where the nodes are located, whether they're line nodes, point nodes, how the nodes respond to impurities, those sorts of questions. So that's saying that this free energy should only depend upon the nodal structure, and it shouldn't depend upon the internal phase of the order parameter. And following through the argument, I claim that my two-point correlator then should also only depend upon the nodal structure. Okay. The pair symmetries are found by multiplying by factors that are plus or minus 1 or 0, which will depend upon the symmetry that you're looking at and the value of little r. So for S-wave, this factor is just 1, doesn't do anything. And for the two D-wave symmetries I'll look at, they have the very standard forms. Nothing new there. Okay, here's what I end up with. Here's my total four-point correlator. This thing I calculated from the TJ model just by plunking down pairs on the lattice. And these are the different symmetries for the two little r's. The structure of this for a fixed value of capital R now is a matrix. It's a matrix that's indexed by the little r values. Okay? So what I want to do in calculating my effective two-point correlator is to construct essentially a scalar from this matrix for each fixed value of capital R.
Yeah. Dumb question. How is this different than what Steve did when he subtracted off, where he said you should look at the pair field susceptibility with the bubble subtracted off?
It's related to the very first step I talked about.
Right. It's not identical to that, though.
Well, there's a number. If you just wait a couple slides, I will address this issue. There's a number of points that are involved. Okay. So the effective correlator, two-point correlator, I generate then. I want to be a scalar generated from this matrix, and there's a number of things you could use here. In particular, you might think of largest eigenvalue, or what I like is the trace. And what I've used as the definition is the trace of this matrix.
Does that mean R prime is equal to R?
Yes, exactly. I'm looking at the diagonal elements of the matrix. One reason for looking at the trace instead of the largest eigenvalue is that the pairs are not point objects to start with here. And as a consequence, the distance between the pairs is not really well defined in general. Whether I use the ends of the pairs or use the center of mass, I can get different values of R prime and R just without moving the pairs, right? The same physical object. So what I would like is my two-point correlator to not depend upon how I define capital R. And the trace has that property. The individual eigenvalues in general will not, because they will depend upon the off-diagonal element. Now, this will not be true when I get into the ordered phase. And it's important to remember I'm not addressing the ordered phase with a condensate. If I had a condensate, this wouldn't matter because I would have one non-zero eigenvalue. And that would have obviously be the trace and the largest eigenvalue. So that wouldn't be a problem. Okay, so this is the final effective two-point correlator then, but written out in detail.
So what does the trace actually give you in terms of the,
right here.
Has it somehow got linked? If you look at the two different points, is it somehow linked? the distance from the center of mass is the same,
yeah,
or something over there. I mean, that seems like a, if I'm understanding it right, it seems like a sum over the wave functions on each pair.
Well, I'm not really summing over the wave functions on each pair. That's the point. I'm calculating a trace of this full four-point correlator. The wave function is a somewhat more detailed property than what I'm addressing. Okay.
Bill, does this? I know you subtract. I know in your very first slide you showed us. I mean, you subtracted out the disconnected,
right,
non-interacting pieces. But suppose I have. Suppose in those zones I end up with two sites separated by one link.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it seemed to me that the parafield correlation at that distance could be just a magnetization correlation. I'm wondering,
right.
Is that?
I'll be my next slide.
Okay. How about if you just imagine that there's only near neighbor pairing correlations that are non-zero?
Right.
Then what does the trace actually give you?
If you just wait just 1 minute, I'll come to a slide where I address this. For my calculation, because I'm only looking at the trace, these symmetry factors come in as a square. The square is only 0 or 1. So indeed, I have something that's only sensitive to the nodes. It will not depend upon the internal symmetry factor of the pair wave function. What this means, though, is that to distinguish different symmetries, I have to be sensitive to the nodes. And to distinguish D wave from S wave, that means I need to at least get to the point where I'm looking at things going on the diagonal. I have to go beyond nearest neighbors to distinguish these different symmetries. Okay. Now, Doug's question. At R equals 0, capital R equals 0, you can write down an exact expression. And this is actually motivated by some work that Doug did in the Hubbard model. I did this for the TJ model, and it's kind of amazing that you can do a rearrangement of the operators in the TJ model and have it come out to be an exact expression. What makes this work is that for the particular correlator I'm looking at, I never need to use the on-site anti-commutator. So I don't need to know what that is. Okay? But what happens is for this R equals 0 effective two-point correlator, you can write it as a sum of two-point correlators of different quantities. Spin-spin correlator, charge-charge correlator, and something which would determine the momentum distribution. Okay. The important thing about this is that when I look at different symmetries of alpha, I leave out the little r's, of course, that lie on the nodes. Right, those I don't include. And now, exactly what Doug was saying happens. For dx squared minus y squared symmetry, you have the problem that this first part, the spin correlator piece here, as you go into the anti-ferromagnet, can actually diverge. And that means that you have a real issue in distinguishing D-wave pairing from anti-ferromagnetism.
We found that, as you know.
Yes, so this is...
That plagued one of our graduate students.
Yes.
Who's now given up physics and has become a man.
Wow.
He's trying to.
Sent him off the earth.
He got very close this year.
Yeah. This is, I think, a really tricky issue. And I know you guys thought about it a long time ago already. I have to think about it, too, in my calculation. The whole point is that this guy can diverge, or be very large at least. So the way you get around this is to look for something that really unambiguously tells you you have pair fluctuations. You need to go beyond just the Q equals zero value and actually look for the Q values around Q equals zero and see that you're developing a peak that is sharpening up and growing as you cool down, or something equivalent to it. And what I'm doing that's equivalent to this is the correlation length. Okay. You could also look in real space and just see that the correlator goes to larger and larger distances as you lower the temperature. So this is a real issue if you want to try and distinguish these two guys. You have to be very careful. And okay, that's one point. Now, there's another set of prior calculations that Matthias mentioned. They all seem to find the same magnitude for the correlator when you got out to large distances. This was his 5 × 10⁻³, right? And it didn't matter whether they claimed there was order present or not. They all seemed to find the same magnitude. This is kind of the structure of those calculations. Now, some details might be different for specific calculations, but the essential point is what they try to do, they make a spin singlet here, that's fine, but then they do a sum over nearest neighbors, building in the D wave plus or minus sign for each individual delta, and then do a correlator of these deltas. Now, the structure that you end up with as a consequence of that looks like this, where I'll use an obvious shorthand here for the notation. Okay, and that's just writing out the four pieces you would get from that sort of correlator. And the symmetry sign is showing up here explicitly. Okay, now, from the series expansion point of view, it's pretty clear that you're going to be in trouble with this calculation. Because if I were to look at, say, the lowest order contribution to this sort of arrangement, where these guys are a distance r apart, and then look at the same sort of thing where I've just reoriented this one pair. So it looks sort of like this. Again, r apart. Now, I'm not including the plus and minus sign here yet. This is just looking at two pairs on the lattice oriented differently. From the series expansion point of view, these have exactly the same lowest order contribution, because it's the minimum cluster which will contribute to these two guys is exactly the same. It doesn't matter if I reorient this one bond. The clusters only depend upon topology. They don't care how you twist and turn the links. So the lowest order, these guys are exactly the same in my series calculation. And as I even go to higher orders, they won't differ by very much. They'll be very, very close in magnitude. So if I have a minus sign here between these two guys, I have a built-in cancellation in the calculation. And what I should expect is to find a very small number. And my guess is this is where the 5 × 10⁻³ is coming from. It's kind of built into the structure of the calculation.
Well, when we do that, we just get a different, let's see, the contribution that you get if we do this with, say, DMRG, say a ladder or a two-node, a little bit wider, is you just get a minus sign between measures. That's the predominant factor. So, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that these should have a positive thing that's canceling.
Yeah.
Yes, and exactly.
We just get positive and negative.
Well, I'll have to talk to you about that later. From the series expansion point of view, these two things should be identical to lowest order. That is definitely true, because the lowest order contribution is exactly the same.
Lowest order is not zero order, it's the first one that comes in.
It's the very first one that comes in, yeah. It'll be however many links are between here will determine the power of beta where the first order contribution shows up.
I get it, the difference between basically zero temperature, and approaching it from high temperature.
There shouldn't be a
difference.
But there shouldn't be a difference to this magnitude, because even if I go to higher order in beta here, these guys are almost going to be equal. It's very difficult to change the plus and minus sign of a contribution simply by going to higher powers in beta. I mean, it can happen, but it's a very rare sort of thing.
It seems you're saying at zero temperature, I can see in lattice that its cancellation was occurring.
Yeah.
I just have to make sense.
Just look at, I want to get this thing.
Ladders could be a different issue, because that will break this symmetry. When I said these being equal, that was the 2D lattice. I go to a ladder, that may not be true anymore, especially a very narrow ladder.
Well, Steve, it has to be correct trivially, right? I mean, you get a plus sign if you're measuring D wave, then you get a minus sign, right?
Right, aren't you saying
No, I'm talking just about this correlator. I'm leaving the sign out for the time being.
Right, but aren't you saying that the lowest order piece is always S wave?
No, the lowest order piece I can define without talking about any symmetry at all. Well, I'm just talking about putting pairs on a lattice and how I orient them.
Well, when we think about doing S wave with the plus signs, then we think of adding them with the same sign.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so the way we would normally do it, if you did have the same sign, you would just say, oh, it's S wave.
Well, as I said, the calculation here, if it's sensitive to these symmetry numbers, these plus and minus signs, I think there's a problem. And I think this is how the problem is showing up. It's giving a small number here.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you haven't said it yet, the creative architecture space. My understanding is that the moment you start to really feel the multiple coherence, the architecture space gets out of control, right?
Eventually, yes.
Yeah.
Well, the temperatures that I will extrapolate down to are a quarter of J.
Yeah. But you're still quite a high temperature, right?
It's not zero.
When you hit this temperature, where things get out of control, the thermal signs get very serious, and everything reshuffles, and that's then explaining the difference.
Well, the fermion signs are not an issue for me.
Because you cannot get below J.
No, the temperature is the issue. The fermion signs are not the issue.
Of course, exponential.
Yeah, no, it's all clear. It's all clear. But it's an issue in the sense that in order to really probe the fermion signs, you have to get the temperatures way below the temperature where.
Well, you'll see that I see pair fluctuations. So then we can argue whether I'm at low enough temperatures.
This is an issue about, you know, that the signs or whatever is going on at very low temperature changes automatically to energy you can calculate on high temperature. And that's the question I'm posing.
Dan, you had a question?
In some sense, you artificially avoided this by making a specific choice of a trace, which brings in these symmetry factors on the square.
Right. I don't think I'm artificially avoiding. I think I'm actually doing the right thing there in avoiding these things. I will only be sensitive to the nodes of the pair wave function. I will not be sensitive to the plus and minus signs that are in the wave function. Yes. That's the point. Yes, I deliberately built it that way.
Do I misunderstand? You only be sensitive to the anti-nodes or the nodes?
Well, the nodes will be...
just wasn't sure of the words.
Right here. This phi squared will be either 1 or 0. The zeros are the nodes, right? So, essentially, in determining different symmetries, what I'll be doing is dropping pieces where the nodes are located.
Yeah. The anti-nodes will contribute to your sign.
Yeah. Well, the nodes shouldn't contribute. They're zero. That's where the wave function goes to zero.
Okay, we just didn't know the definition of the word sensitive.
Okay. Let me go on and show you what I find. I've looked at three different symmetries. They're all singlet, or in the Ginzburg-Landau sense. S and DXY really do not do much of anything. The largest correlation length I find as a function of doping is only around a third of a lattice spacing. As I cool down, the dx squared minus y squared guy grows very sharply as a function of doping and reducing temperature. I'm going to fix my parameters, and almost all the data I show you is to be j over t of 0.4. And most of the time when I'm looking at a specific doping, it'll be 20%. So I'm going to kind of try to stay away from the pseudo-gap regime for the time being. Let me look at now a little more detail at dx squared minus y squared behavior. This now is looking again at the correlation length as a function of doping for different temperatures. This lowest curve is temperature equal to J, 0.8, 0.6, 0.4, 0.25. So the real growth in the correlation length is below around half of J. And the next slide will be a cut through this maximum as a function of temperature.
Mm-hmm. So, which is, I think, your expansion, maybe doing it to decimals, how this famous stuff going back to Stendi, for instance.
Well, it goes back to the
extrapolations to very low temperature. That's all the way up real phase transition that you get out of control. My understanding is that in these thermal problems, that these explanations sometimes work. So basically, your strategy is you push that high temperature expansion to such a high order that you're forced to do these extrapolations.
I have a 12th order series, and I extrapolate it down as far as I can, where I still have some control over the craziness of the padays. Yeah, and these are actually 10% error bars. They're plus or minus 10%.
Are you going to show us the tails of the real space distribution? Because I'm worried that when you have a short correlation like that, the local physics is dominating.
Well, I can't get, that's true, I can't get the pairs real far apart, because
but even five spaces apart?
Well, what happens is that for every either space in little r or capital R that I increase things, I basically lose two powers of beta in terms of where the series starts. Since I'm limited to 12, the maximum range at which I get any information is about six lattice spacing. And there the information has fallen off, and it's only contributing at the highest order. So it's true. The information is largely coming from short-range correlations. That's what limits me to a temperature of only a quarter of J. Yeah. This is the temperature dependence through that maximum behavior. S wave really is doing nothing. It is flat at this temperature range. And the dx squared minus y squared is growing fairly sharply. That's what I find.
And what would S x squared plus y squared look like?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Extended S wave.
That's what this is.
That is extended S wave.
Yes, there's no on-site S wave here.
So
U is infinite.
Can I follow that up? The nodes that you spoke about earlier when you're constructing the pair collider, those are only symmetry-driven nodes.
Right.
Have whatever Fermi surface I like, which crossed, which gave the extended S some nodes, but it doesn't matter.
Right. Well, the nodes would have to be determined by this function here. If there was something that was non-symmetry driven, it would have to come out of the TJ model calculation for some reason. And as far as I know, that doesn't happen for S wave. If I look in any particular direction, it doesn't go to zero for some model specific reason. Now, another point to address is that if you really do have pair fluctuations developing, they should affect the single particle spectrum. They should affect the density of states in the single particle spectrum. I don't have direct access to the frequency dependence easily. In principle, it can be calculated by this method, but it's a tremendous amount of work. So as far as I know, no one has done it. What I can look at, however, are temperature derivatives. Sit at low temperature and look at temperature derivatives. The idea is that if I'm at a low enough temperature, this will show me in momentum space where the low energy excitations are. In particular, I want to look at the temperature derivative of the momentum distribution. If you do this for a BCS superconductor where we have a well-defined expression for things, you can show at low temperatures that this temperature derivative goes as 1 over the magnitude of the gap. So if your gap is developing nodes, as you would expect, that's where you find a lot of low energy excitations, and this temperature derivative will be large. Okay, so that's what I'm going to look for in the TJ model. I have a little movie which shows how this develops. So the big plot is this temperature derivative over the full Brillouin zone, and up here in the corner is a plot of the pair correlation length, the same parameter choices, and the temperature will start at J. So this line as it moves down shows what temperature we're at. At high temperatures, basically nothing as much is happening. The correlation length is less than half a lattice spacing, and these guys are just look like nice arc-shaped features. But as we go below half of J for the temperature, things change. and they change in complete accord with the temperature dependence of the correlation line. Now, these are two completely separate calculations. They're both done, obviously, for the same model and by the same technique. But the momentum distribution calculation is a lot easier. And there really isn't any ambiguity about how to do it. It's a simple two-point correlator.
I agree you can calculate it very easily, but what does it mean?
It's the momentum distribution.
But it's the temperature dependence, the temperature derivative of the momentum.
Right, right. This would be something that would be related to the spectral weight at these particular k values. It's trying to use the temperature derivative to get at the energy dependence. That's what I'm trying to do. Because I don't have a direct handle on the energy dependence as a parameter that I can play with.
Should I just think of it as the sharpness of the Fermi surface?
In some sense, yeah, in some sense that's what's happening. Yeah.
But that's not necessarily related to pairing. It could be antiferromagnetic scattering or antiferromagnetic fluctuations or different things. So there's not a one-to-one correspondence.
I worry about that already.
Sorry.
It's possible this could be related to the pseudogap. That would be a possibility. Because we expect from the experiments, the pseudogap also has nodes on the diagonal. Right? That's what we know. Now, in the calculations I do, I can look at the uniform spin susceptibility, chi naught, and I can look for where this goes through a maximum as a function of temperature. This is one of the experimental signatures that's used for the pseudogap. This is something that I can calculate, and I can plot this on a doping temperature phase diagram and see how it relates to things. And that's what this is. The black line here is that maximum as a function of doping and temperature. Where I was showing the movie is out here at 20%. It's cutting down like this. And the maximum in the pair correlation length is out here at about 25% doping. What this tells me is I'm not looking at the pseudogap in that movie. And the pair correlations seem to be not strongly related to the pseudogap in this model. They seem to really be two separate places.
The difference between the black and the gray?
The gray curves are the antiferromagnetic correlation length. The black curve does seem to be very strongly related to the antiferromagnetic correlation length. It almost is following one of these contours at a little bit less than 1.5 lattice spacing. It does seem to be strongly related to that. But the superconductivity is out here.
And what is the largest antiferromagnetic correlation length that you can obtain?
Oh, the largest one that I tried to get to was only 2 lattice spacings. That's right here. They will be growing as you go down into this corner. Okay. Out here, where the superconductivity is strongest, the correlation length, antiferromagnetic correlation length, is around 1/2 a lattice spacing or less. There's a very strong growth in the pair correlation length as the antiferromagnetic correlation length is decreasing below about 1 lattice spacing.
Bit of an unrelated issue. So you can think about delta N of K delta T, say, assume that you have a perfect Fermi gas, and then it would reflect the workings of the Fermi dirac distribution. Now you're still at pretty high temperatures, so you're physically still pretty local. I wonder if you can make statements about kind of the damping, to what extent you can really say that this is like a Fermi gas that gets hit by several distributions.
No, N of K really does not resemble a Fermi gas in the sense of developing a step. It resembles a Fermi gas to the extent that it seems to be a large shape to it, but it will not have
a sharp step. Basically, like you take a small crystal and you particle hops around in a crystal and you get momentum information, which is all related to a real Fermi surface. So the question is a bit like, how can we distinguish this? Local physics is the development of a real Fermi surface.
Well, N of K has to satisfy a sum rule.
It's all clear, yeah.
I don't know what more to say about that. I can only start at high temperature and cool down.
Because you know how delta-FK delta would look like for a burning gas.
Right, and it,
and compare it with what you have and see if there's any comparison at all, or...
No, they look actually very different. They have similar sort of features in the sense of you'll get positive contributions to the temperature curve, you'll get negative contributions, but it doesn't look anything like a simple Fermi gas.
I sort of say it's likely at high temperatures.
Well, the lowest temperature I've looked at here is 0.2J. That's 300 Kelvin. So it depends upon where you want to put the scale of the momentum distribution in terms of energy. But 300 Kelvin seems to be a fairly low scale for most.
Do you have any plots you should show us? It's just N of K versus K?
Not as part of the presentation, unfortunately. But this is something which we looked at a long time ago, and this is more than 10 years ago.
Go back to the plot you were showing.
This one?
So even if you were going to build superconductivity at low enough temperature, these red lines, you would be saying that the antimagnetic correlation length would not be larger than that minus.
Yes. Yes, this contour is coming down very sharply here. There's more curvature in these contours as you get closer to half filling, but as you go out to larger doping, they become almost vertical lines at this temperature range. They would curve back in, obviously, to half filling as you went to higher and higher temperatures, but I would have to go above the maximum temperature here, which is 1.5J.
So your T star line and your superconducting dome would be completely separate?
Yes.
If you include next neighbor Coulomb repulsion, what it will be?
Well, next nearest neighbor interaction, I think, is important if you want to compare to the real material. That I would agree with. I don't know what happens if you include longer range repulsions. I haven't tried to do that.
But what does next neighbor with your...
I don't know. I'd love to do it, but I don't know what happens. I haven't done the calculation. Unfortunately, by this technique, to go back and put in a T prime and a J prime means starting from the beginning again. It's not something you can just kind of put in at the end of the calculation. You really have to go back to the beginning and have a completely new set of clusters that you define the calculation on. So it's a bit of work. That's why I haven't done it. It's the obvious thing to do, is to try and put in these longer range interactions and see what happens.
Another question. Can you calculate actually some real physical quantity, not per correlation function, but something which characterizes superconductivity, I mean Meissner effect or?
I'm always in the normal state, so I'm stuck looking at fluctuations if I want to address superconductivity.
For example, something which characterizes Meissner effect. Can you calculate such quantity or only per correlation function?
I'm pretty much limited to equal time correlators. So it's what you can get from that. Though, as I mentioned, you can put in some frequency dependence, but it's a tremendous amount of work. And as a consequence, no one's really done it.
Kind of a nerdy question. So in the time since you've done these calculations accessible, the power of accessible supercomputers is increased by a factor of 1,000 or 10,000.
Yes.
You're restricted to 12th order, which takes you to J over 4. How much higher order can you go if you use?
My hope would be to reach at least 16th order.
And how much and further down in temperature does that get?
That's very hard to say without doing it. I mean, there's
some idea.
Well,
I'm not trying to give you a hard time. You do it.
The goal would... This would be the best of all possible worlds if the calculation worked. Do 16th order and reach 0.1J.
Right. Do you think
that would be room. That would be 150 Kelvin.
Right.
That would be the best possible goal that I would like. And
you
that kind
of higher doping. Just the same.
The calculation is done. The density is a parameter in the coefficients. So the way the calculation is done, it's done in the grand canonical ensemble. For the TJ model, you can do an exact inversion to get to the canonical ensemble, so that you can talk about the chemical potential at fixed density. And as a consequence, density, J over T, the symmetry, all of these things are parameters that once you've got the calculation done, you have them as free parameters. You can choose any value within the physically reasonable set.
So suppose you relax the double sum on the R's in order to speed up the calculation, say just do the nearest neighbor ones. Can you get to higher order?
In principle, yes. That would mean that you'd have a fewer clusters that would contribute at a given order, so you could push it farther. When I did this calculation, the computer runs were done, oh gosh, when were they done? Probably 2002, 2003, somewhere in that area. It took me a year of running on the computer, running on a parallel cluster where I was using 16 processors for most of that year. So it was a significant amount of computer time for a solid year.
Force an issue here. Mm-hmm. You take your first statement, and I'm going to say that more strongly. Namely, the fact that your T star and your tone are separated tells you that the single band TJ model cannot describe the Kubernetes.
That, well, in a sense of fitting the exact experimental data, that is correct. On the other hand, theoretically, it tells you something very interesting.
Wait.
Wait a minute. I would disagree. What you mean is the single band with just nearest neighbor hopping.
Right.
I mean, certainly in right. the functional ORG calculations, the pairing is much strengthened in for hole doping when you add T-front and move the an hole singularity away from half-filling.
What I would expect if I put in a T prime is that these guys would come together and look much more like reality.
No, that's fine. I mean, I'm just trying to say we have to do something.
Right.
I think that's what Boris has also said.
Yeah.
And I was just trying to get that stated as a strong statement.
That's exactly what this.
Gently in the computational stuff. I mean,
that's exactly what this result is saying. Yeah. But theoretically, what it's saying is that if you want to understand where the fluctuations are coming from, is that this stuff is not strongly related to what's going on here, if you believe that this is the pseudo-gap region.
Yeah, no, I understand those caveats, but I mean, it's a pretty strong statement.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Bill.
Yes.
I've got two questions. It's going back to the last question, right? You can estimate, I guess, a typical scale for the pair binding, right? You already have these. Let me go back to this nice plot here.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I should read here that the pair binding is of order of 0.2 J.
Well, I would say that two things. The pair correlator really starts to grow at around half of J. And when I looked at the temperature derivative of N of K, it seems to have a strong effect on that at about half of J. And that's where this is going through roughly half a lattice spacing. Now,
I'm very finished with this half a lattice spacing.
Yeah, I know, it's not a long
and I
correlation.
Would say that, you know, when you sort of extrapolate a curve and go through the roof, there I see pair binding, and then I would say it's like 0.2 or 0.5 J.
If you believe this, quasi fit to these data points, which I'm not going to put a lot of weight on.
I'm interested in an order of magnitude more than, you know.
Right, right. Let me tell you where this line is going.
This is that you can give us an order of magnitude.
Let me tell you where this line is going here. This line is a fit to the data points that are shown, and admittedly that's over a very short temperature range. The structure of the fit is like this. It's an exponential of 1 over square root of t. So it's a quasi-Coster-Lasalle sort of fit where I've just set tc equal to 0. Now,
that's
I don't know.
Right, because it sort of separates phase fluctuations from the amplitude bit, and amplitude bit is the significant
one. I have no idea how much to believe this fit because it's over a very short range in temperature. But if you believe this line going up here, when I reach 0.1 J, I'll have a correlation length of a little bit more than 3 lattice spacings.
Yeah. And that, I feel, is a good
sense of
the
pair of binding.
0.1 J, about 150 Kelvin.
10%.
Yeah, 10% of J is about 150 Kelvin. The correlation length will be a little bit more than 3 lattice spacings. Now, this is a physics question which I don't have a good answer to. Is that big enough to make any sense in the real material?
The less point is, you know, this thing's folklore, to completely ignore the fact that the Kunov force exists, right? And as you build this, so when you bring these to
the Coulomb force is built into this.
No, the Coulomb force is one of R, and not all.
Oh, it's short range, right? That I would.
The Coulomb force is screened. It's not one over R.
Yeah, but it's sort of on a screening length, and I wouldn't know it's very big. And I agree, it won't be like this sort of one electron volt you would expect for completely unscreened intersectional scalar for any spin, of course not. But thinking of the Kelvin. It's a tiny energy scale, right?
But I'm at 20% doping. I'm at 20% doping here, so yeah, there's plenty of mobile charge.
Yeah, but then it's a matter of faith to say, the Coulomb force is completely disappeared because the screening is so perfect.
No, it's essentially infinite on site. And
there's a folklore nobody has ever calculated precisely.
Well, in this calculation, it's infinite on site. Well, I would disagree with that.
It's so tactful.
Come on, you're looking at 50 Jim on this.
I'm not worried about it. Yeah, I told you I needed a stick.
It's a big issue, right? Left when you're a bit outside his business.
But let me ask the collective wisdom of the audience then about some numbers. Let's say that we are looking at a tenth of J. So we want a TC of 150 Kelvin. I just said the correlation length is about 3 lattice spacings there. So the square of that's around a factor of 10. Kind of a rough order of magnitude estimate of how big the coupling between the layers would have to be to give me a 3D superconductor then is about 15 Kelvin. Is that a reasonable number? I've been looking in the literature, and I can't really answer that question one way or the other.
I think we could check it by looking at some of the plasma, Josephson plasma frequency, or some of the
axis penetration. Yeah, there must be some way of getting a handle on this number.
Experts right over there.
Well, actually, I got two questions. I do want to stay a little bit longer with Jan's kind of line of inquiry about this, about the form terms. I think we have enough of the expertise in this room, in Morris, Bill, Doug, and others, to tell us what to expect from the form terms. So if I'm learning now a new TJ model or cover model, what would you tell me about the form terms in these materials? All the way of declaring the model and proceeding in the way of kind of finding out.
I mean, if I look at the functional RG calculations, the main thing that drives the D-wave pairing is the strong repulsion scattering connecting the antinodal regions, which is a large Q scattering. It's a pi-pi scattering. That's the main thing driving it. Now, it is true that we also find attractive scatterings developing as we go down, and maybe these conversations stimulate to go back and look what happens if one starts not with a Hubbard U, but with an interaction with a different form in Q space to include the repulsive interactions. Now, when you start with an on-site Hubbard U, of course, in Q space, or in K space, you have a constant repulsive interaction that you start with for all momentum transfers. And yet you develop on the low energy scale attractive scatterings for certain momentum transfers. And I firmly believe you, when you talk about superconductivity, you have to look in K-space. You don't look in real space. You have to look at what the scatterings in K-space are.
But the question was about the Coulomb term before we start talking about superconductivity. What is the role of mixing the
magnitude? Well, what I would say, it would give you a repulsive interaction. If you started an RG calculation on the high energy scale, that had some structure in Q space that was always repulsive. The present calculations use a constant interaction, always repulsive in Q space, and yet develop attractive interactions for certain momentum transfers. But the driving thing for the deep wave pairing is the strong
scattering between antinodal directions, which is repulsive.
I understand this, Morris. Yeah. I understand very well. I was even a part of the conversation earlier on. But my question is different. I know from the mean field analysis, I need to pull the nearest neighbor attraction because the onside pool, onside cover terminal, drops out the moment I start talking about the gearing. However, if there is a nearest neighbor repulsion, I need to work harder to place a dealer to compare. And I'm working on talking, speaking from the real space perspective.
I say you should look in case space.
Yeah, for another way of saying it, Morris, it's like, what? We know the plasma frequency, right? Which is actually quite low. It's like 4 or something. And then, I guess, in order to get a sense of screening length, you wire in a thermal velocity out there. Mm-hmm. And then I guess you could estimate that the screening length is sort of extending a unit cell dimensions of that order. And then it's like somehow for these higher TCs you need relatively local pairs. I'm not saying that they're really localized there. And then it's like say your pair is like has linear dimensional sea lattice constant or something of that kind. And then you have the screen Kulomb interaction, which is a screening length which is of order of the lattice constant, but the number you have to plug in there is sort of the bare Coulomb interaction is modulo high frequency epsilon naught, right? Now, I don't know exactly what the number is, but I don't think it's zero. I think it's still, you know.
I think what you're looking for is an instability in K space.
Of course.
What is important is the structure of the scattering the scattering vertices in K-space, not in real space.
But eventually I can fully transform it back to real space, and I see that this
parasitic. What I'm saying is we start from a totally repulsive interaction at high energy scale, and yet we generate an attraction out of it.
For
certain matrix elements in case.
You know, for functional initialization group, I think it's very low post. Just start out with the bare Coulomb interaction plus added hardcore pieces to the number two piece, and then, you know, really calculate such that you get all the, you know, screen
positions,
and then ask the question.
But we start with a functional interaction, so, you know, for all matrix elements.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter that you have a Coulomb interaction really between their electrons, right?
I'm just trying to understand and follow up respectfully, Morris. This is not the issue. The issue is that if you put the on-site Coulomb, we understand very well that what happened, but once you start looking at the giver channel, like you're saying, you do get the attraction. But you do get attraction essentially in a way that in the giver channel, on-site Hubbard term is irrelevant.
No.
No? Fine. But the question is actually whatever it's doing.
Why? Because it gives you pi-pi scattering, repulsive pi-pi scattering.
I see. So you're saying any little bit of nearest neighbor repulsion wouldn't change anything?
I differ on this, and I'm afraid, Morris, I differ from you. I think we can look in momentum space, or we can look in real space. And I think when we look in real space, it's easier to understand the word attraction, because what's happened, I think, in real space is two electrons trying to go onto the same site meet this incredibly large Hubbard view. So, you know, it's very repulsive. But when one Fourier transforms the four-point interaction, one finds that it has an attraction on near neighbor sites that comes from the spin spin fluctuations. But is just another way, I think, of saying is attractive in a channel that transfers large pi-pi momentum. And it's the large pi-pi, very positive scattering that one Fourier transform puts an oscillation in.
You do not want attractive pi-pi scattering. That's going to kill you if you...
As you go near pi-pi.
For a D wave, you want to have a repulsive pi-pi scattering. You want to have a strong repulsive interaction between the antinodal positions.
I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, okay.
You are in momentum space.
Yes.
And in momentum space, near pi-pi, if you look at the interaction, it is positive.
Repulsive, you mean?
It is positive, and I won't call it repulsive or attraction, because in a moment it's going to be attractive. Because this large repulsive, pardon me, this large positive interaction is Fourier transform. And what you do, you pick up a cosine of the momentum Q, capital QX of L, plus cosine of QY of L. And because that Q is pi, when you go out L, this beast changes its sign, and in real space, you see it's attractive. And so I believe that if you want to talk attractive, you should talk in space-time what's happening, and that it is confusing, or not confusing, it is different if you insist on staying in momentum space, and which is fine, you can do that. But then what bothers me is exactly Lev's question, and Lev's been torturing me for several weeks, which is, if you believe, as I do, that you can also look at it in real space, and then what's happening with the simple Hubbard model is you're getting a definite attraction to form singular pairs when you put them on near neighbor sites. And Lev wants me to add a near neighbor coolant. He doesn't even want what Jan wants. Jan wants the whole ball of wax screen. Lev is now, after arguing with him for a week or two, willing to let me just look at near neighbor. If we put a near neighbor Coulomb interaction on, then you can do what you want. But the Fourier transform, of course, Morrison, go back into your gauge base. But when you feed it through your calculations, it is going to hurt the flow as you find.
Well, it's not obvious to me how much it will hurt, because, as I say, we start with something that's totally repulsive. Now, if we sort of modulate the strength of the repulsion of it in Q space, we could take a look and see.
That's
no problem to calculate.
I think it would be very interesting.
Okay, we could take a look at that, but I don't think that, since we started with everything repulsive, it's not as though we're starting with some attraction. They're not. We're starting with everything repulsive in K-space and still getting a D-ray pair. Sorry.
There's no need to stop.
I think the issue is that there is, at least for me, as a very skeptical person regarding, superconductivity, Hubbard models or decay models, there is this case involving the different direction that actually there is superconductivity. So I like to think it's now time to take the next step and say the Hubbard model is a decay model, ladies and gentlemen, and it was not figured out to be like the standard model of high energy physics. We leave out all kind of other things. The most obvious thing that we leave out is the impulsive finite range quantum interactions. It's time to start investigating this. By now be more that you're right, but I would like to see a calculation demonstrating.
I'd love to do the calculation, but it's a lot of work. Now I'd like to get to the title of the talk. No matter what your personal beliefs on the issue, set that aside for a moment and just run with the fact that there are fluctuations, pair fluctuations in this model. What's left to understand is where they're coming from, how they develop in the strongly correlated model. A usual approach, and one that has a lot of variations in terms of the details, is to use some fluctuations in another order parameter, generate an interaction. This then, through a secondary step, generates the pair fluctuation. This always leaves standing, though, a question as to why the stronger fluctuation isn't the guy that orders in the first place. And I don't have a good answer to that question. I would love to hear a good answer to that question, but I don't have one. Because of that, I'm going to take a somewhat different tack and see if I can essentially avoid that question by saying that instead of going through a secondary fluctuation, I'm going to try and see if there's a way you can get pair fluxions directly as a fluctuation produced by the strong correlations. Okay? What this will mean then is that I would say that all types of order parameter fluctuations will be competing, and it's really survival of the fittest, and the strongest one wins. Okay, that's kind of the approach I would like to take.
The alternative approach here, D-wave is already a consequence of strong correlation, right? So
well, the two approaches here have different problems. They both have issues. I've addressed explicitly the issue of the first approach of using essentially a primary fluctuation to produce the pairing as a secondary fluctuation. You have this question to deal with. The issue for going directly from the strong correlations is now you've got to come up with a new mechanism. You've got to have some way of taking the strong correlations and producing the D-wave fluctuations. So they both have their problems. I'm not going to say that either one is without problems. Now, an important point is that from the data I've shown so far, we know that this mechanism, whatever it is, has to exist already at about J over 2. Because that's where the fluctuations really start doing their thing in the model. So what that suggests is that we should look first at higher temperatures, see if we can identify what the degrees of freedom are, and then start cooling the system down and see what fluctuations develop. So that's the approach I'm going to take. Now, here's my brief foray into the Hubbard model. And it's going to be only for very large U and very high temperatures. What I want to do is look at the Hubbard model on site, the single site approximation. So I'm going to stay at very large parameter values and not have the hopping between the sites be useful. The way I'm going to try to identify the degrees of freedom is by looking at the entropy. And the nice thing about the single site Hubbard model approximation is that we have analytic expressions for the entropy that we can look at, and we can look at them in different limits and see what formulas come out. Just to show that this does work in a situation where we know the answer, let's look at the negative U Hubbard model. Here we know if we're at very high temperatures that we have essentially non-interacting electrons. And that shows up as the entropy being twice the contribution you'd get from an itinerant piece, which is at density n over 2. So it's the spin-ups and spin-downs being independent. Okay?
Festival lattice gas.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, start cooling things down and notice the temperature scale. I wrote it in terms of little t, but the values here are huge. So the lowest temperatures I'm going down to are only on the order of little t. So I'm really not going very cold. But there's this wonderful crossover, which people know about for large negative U in the Hubbard model, where the entropy now will change from being the non-interacting electron situation to hardcore bosons. The two electrons are getting glued together on a single site, and they act like a boson. And that's showing up here in the entropy. You have the entropy of half the number of particles. And this shows up even more clearly when you look at the full thermodynamics. The free energy is dominated by the internal energy. And that's the gluing together of these two electrons. The entropy here, the minus TS term in the free energy, isn't playing much of a role in this crossover. There's a light gray crossover region which is not showing up on this slide. Where it says crossover region here, there's kind of a wedge of light gray. You'll have to look at these slides, I'm afraid, on the web or somewhere else where you can see all the details. But the idea is that there's weakly correlated at high temperature. You go through a crossover region, and at low temperature, we have effective hardcore bosons. And this is what we know happens for large negative U. And this shows up in this single-site approximation very clearly in the entropy.
So can I comment on the left one just to make sure I have it? It looks to my eye like minus TS is playing a greater role on F than E is.
Well, it will out at large temperatures. It has to. It has to take over. But there's a crossover region which is roughly from here to here. And what I was arguing is in that region, it really is the energy which is taking over and determining what this low temperature behavior below the crossover is. Whereas the entropy is a fairly small contribution to the free energy.
Just a naive question, right?
in the hardcore boson, you get boson, but there's no phase ordering. It's not a supercondensation.
No.
It's just
no.
Errors.
There would be below that at a much lower temperature.
And they order.
They order. Yeah. I'm not going anywhere near that low temperature.
I just want to make sure I understood.
Yeah. I'm cutting off the temperature roughly at T, little T.
That's fine.
So you know, this is a very high temperature. More interesting case is what happens for positive U. Same approximation, just the on-site Hubbard model, single-site Hubbard model. There's again a crossover that shows up. It's exactly the same formula. All I've done is flip the sign on U. This plot is for a U of 12. The other plot was for a U of minus 12. Okay, so same magnitude, just flip the sign. Again, at high temperatures, I have the exact same value as I had before because the U isn't playing a role. But now as I go through this crossover, I come down to a value which has this form right here. These first two terms look like an itinerant system of density n. Right? That's the total entropy of that sort of system. But then I have this other piece here, which looks like density n of localized spin a halves. That's what comes out of this.
So, Bill, what is the itinerant system of n? The first two rules of the low temperature limit?
I didn't hear the first part of your question.
You get a crossover. At low temperatures, you have this n log n, 1 minus n.
Right.
What is this? This is no longer an hardcore
bosons. Exactly. I'm coming up to that. That's the next question. What are these degrees of freedom? One can, again, get some information by looking at the full thermodynamics instead of just the entropy. What one finds for the positive U case, again, the crossover isn't showing up. It's from roughly here to here. The free energy is dominated by the entropy term. The energy isn't playing much of a role here. The reason for that, for the positive U case, is rather simple. I can only minimize the energy so much by not having things on site. Then I get zero, and that's it. I can't reduce the energy any more than that. So it's the entropy that is dominating the free energy here. This is a very different type of physical process than the negative U case, where it was the energy gluing things together. The entropy wants to create as many degrees of freedom as possible. But the large U is preventing that from becoming as large as is allowed. So what I claim is happening, or this is all motivation for what I claim is happening in the TJ model eventually. What I claim is happening is that the large net positive U is forcing constrained entropy maximization. And it's really a back of the envelope calculation of combinatorics to show that you get exactly this formula for the entropy if you have no doubly occupied sites.
This is completely ignoring any H bar effect, right?
This is all at very high temperatures, yes.
Reduce the consisting the equivalent Venice gas model.
Yes, I'm using this to try and get some ideas to where this effect is coming from, but I will show more explicitly in the TJ model what the effect of this is. Okay, but what I claim is happening is that this is what I would call spin charge separation. It's happening at very high temperatures. Okay, and it's driven by this need to maximize the entropy below this constrained crossover. Now,
I'm sorry, I guess I'm stuck on the previous one. You showed two pieces to entropy terms. One is the envelope two, which is the localized spin, so those are the spin-ons now?
At this temperature, there isn't any effect of the hopping terms or any other multi-site interaction terms. So you can't really say whether they're going to be mobile or localized or whatever. All you can do is count degrees of freedom. But when I look at the TJ model, I will then go down in temperature, and we'll look to see what happens to these degrees of freedom. Okay, now the way that I'm going to try and investigate these things is again using temperature derivatives of correlation functions. And just to set the idea here, I made the plots of the non-interacting cases. And this is what one would expect to happen. You get a large peak at Q equals zero in the temperature derivative of either the spin-spin or the density-density correlator. These are just Q equals zero excitations. And you get a large negative feature out at 2 kF. which is unfortunately not showing up real well in that, but it's kind of this orange and yellow line that goes around the Brillouin zone. If I change the shape of the Fermi surface, the shape of 2KF, of course, also changes.
You're now at zero temperature.
This is low temperature. This is a temperature of around 0.2 J.
Exactly
it's not right. Exactly zero
so
temperature.
Another example, completely different by Fermi energy.
Right.
So the dynamics is not completely governed by the Fermi energy.
Yes, yes. But I'm only getting very small regions in the Brillouin zone where I have anything happening. 2KF and Q equals zero. Yeah. So what happens in the TJ model? We want to try and apply the same sort of analysis there. If I just look at the correlators, density correlator and spin-spin correlator, they don't look particularly unusual. They look more or less like everyone else has shown them to be. So I won't dwell on that very much. The temperature derivatives, though, are interesting. Let me look at the temperature derivative of the density-density correlator first. The top frame in both sides here is just looking at a proper perspective Brillouin zone plot. And then below that, I have a three-dimensional plot, which is kind of at an angle. This red and blue thing here is the Q equals zero central peak. And it's huge. On the scale of this lower plot, this is 0.01. The peak goes up to 0.08. So it would go off the top of the page on the scale. So the Q equals zero excitations are definitely there for the charged excitations. But the 2KF feature is quite different than what you might expect for a Fermi sort of surface-driven behavior. It has a large 2KF sort of feature, this yellow and orange region here, which goes around. Unfortunately, it doesn't show up real clearly, but it doesn't go all the way to the corner here. It's cut off. This comes up above zero here. It has the shape in momentum space of this guy right here. It has that general shape, but it's a lot broader. It's a lot broader in momentum. Okay, and this shape, which you can't tell from this plot, this shape already sets in at a very high temperature, a little below little t. You will already see this shape, and it doesn't narrow up as I cool below. As I go down, this is at 0.3 J, so this is well below little t. It's not narrowing up. It's staying very broad. So it doesn't look like it is showing an underlying Fermi surface sort of behavior yet. Unless you go even to much lower temperature. Yeah?
So this peak at Q equals zero, it's a common feature. Could you tell me what it is?
It's just Q equals zero excitations. If you had a Fermi surface, it would just be making particle hole excitations near the Fermi surface.
This is not at the end of K. This is actually charge fluctuations.
Right. It'd just be charge fluctuations near the Fermi surface. So you would expect to get that no matter what your charge degrees of freedom are, you should get that, right? Because that's just a very local in momentum sort of thing. It's the 2KF feature here, which is very strange. But it does look like it's an itinerant degree of freedom, right? It has that full Brillouin zone shape to it, and it looks itinerant.
I find it a bit dangerous, right? Because it can be really very short distance information. Right? You think you have some composite object. Is that out of the electrons that hop around here, all the levels per can, and that would already be all this momentum space information. So I'm less impressed actually by momentum space exclusion in play. I would think that you really should look for how the temperature is this exactly where is there any sign of both and Fermi statistics going on there?
It's very hard to look for statistics effects. It's hard to look for statistics effects in an equal time correlator. Yes, I understand that very well. Yes. But the second point I'd like to make about this is then to look at the spin degrees of freedom. And here things really look odd. I mean, they just look strange, and it's kind of difficult to see the details of what's going on. There isn't a real sharp peak around Q equals zero. There's more kind of a broad blob, which occupies a very significant part of the Brillouin zone. And what's even stranger is that if I go in the pi zero direction, the temperature derivative stays positive. It doesn't have a 2kF feature in that direction. There's no negative temperature derivative. The negative temperature derivative is located out here in the zone corners only. So it's kind of this relatively large area centered on pi pi. So this really doesn't look like something where I'm down to a temperature where I can see a Fermi surface yet.
Is your main case, how does nobody just say decoupling? Kind of
yeah. This big blob in the zone center actually is more or less what you'd get for this temperature derivative in the Heisenberg model. If you had a localized Heisenberg model and look at the temperature dependence of this correlator, you would see this big blob develop in the zone center. Positive blob. Yeah.
Do you have them in real space?
Well, that's where all this starts, but I don't have the plots of them in real space in general. There's not going to be anything terribly unusual. This is what they look like in momentum space at lowest temperature. This is 0.3J. I agree. It's
maybe this large momentum features can be easily seen in the real space. This that's where you get up this morning. Maybe if you look in the 4x4, there's quite a bit of the physics encoded on the short.
There will have to be. There will have to be. Yeah.
Other description.
I have some other plots that I could show you after the talk, but I don't have them as part of the presentation. Now, let's go back one. Yep. The other thing that happens with these temperature derivatives is that the energy scales of these 2 degrees of freedom are really very different. The charge degrees of freedom at 20% doping really seem to have an energy scale where they start to behave in a more or less coherent manner at about little t. Whereas the spins, you have to get much colder, around J over 2. And for the ratio of J over t that I'm looking at of 0.4, the ratio of these two energy scales is about 5. Okay, so the charge degrees of freedom have an energy scale up here. Spins are down here somewhere.
The accepted mean is cold here, so.
Well, this is more or less what I mean. These are now looking at some temperature plots at specific momentum values. This is pi pi, this is pi zero. And I've plotted three things here. The solid line is spinless fermions just as a reference mark. The squares are hardcore bosons and the triangles are the TJ model. So what happens at high temperatures, all these guys are more or less doing the same thing. At some temperature here, the hardcore bosons turn over and go down. TJ model does something rather similar. It doesn't go down as much at pi pi, but it goes down. And that would be a very odd thing for it to do if it were behaving like a simple Fermi liquid in a nice, well-defined Fermi surface.
So it should be as a temperature of 2J.
Around 2 to 2.5 J is where things.
The solid body very flexible object is starts to exceed the distances between the charges. And quantum effects kick in and they look like alcohol.
Yeah, something is changing at about that temperature. And it's even more stark when you come over here to the pi zero point. Here's spinless fermions and here's hardcore bosons and TJ. They're almost identical out at this wave vector. This is very, very unusual. I mean, especially out at these large wave vectors, you would think that if they were behaving like in a Fermi manner, that they would just kind of saturate at some temperature. And they're not doing that. Okay. Now, if you really believe, and I know I'm going farther and farther out on the branch, I'm probably out at the twigs or maybe with the leaves already and maybe the veins in the leaves, I don't know. But if you really believe you have something behaving like hardcore bosons at a relatively high temperature, and the spins are totally incoherent yet, what those hardcore bosons will try to do is behave like hardcore bosons. And they will try to produce some sort of fluctuations leading to a pair condensate of some kind. Now, these bosons, it's important to remember, are not the real degrees of freedom of the system. Underlying everything are electrons. So you can't make a single boson condensate. That just cannot happen. You don't have real bosons in the problem. So this gets cut off, and I don't have the data to show this, but it's very interesting. There's been a mystery in the N of K calculations for a long time that a temperature scale of order J over 2 appears in those calculations. And it's a very strange number because you're looking at something that should be more or less determined by the hopping. So why does J over 2 appear? Well, that's where these guys are starting to realize that they're really electrons and they're not bosons. And this correlation is getting cut off. It can't grow below that temperature.
J is where coherence starts to appear.
In the spins.
No, in the charged tuning. It's where coherent quasi-particles start to appear.
Yeah.
J, not T.
Yeah, well, that's where you'd start being, right, you'd start developing coherence. Yeah. However, if you have these sorts of fluctuations, the single boson fluctuations, you should have higher order fluctuations too. These guys can match up with the spins to make real electronic fluctuations. So when you get below a temperature of order J over 2, you're going to really produce electronic pair fluctuations out of this.
You have to wire in here also the possibility of phase protection, right?
There's once you have bosons around, there's lots of possibilities that can happen. No, there really is. I mean, if you put in
non-committal as possible,
if you put in slightly somewhat small longer range interactions, you can drive all sorts of structures in these bosons.
I mean, pair compensation completely dimensional for bosons.
Yeah. What I haven't addressed in this talk is what happens if I go to lower doping than 20%. If I were to go down to around 10% doping, all these energy scales would become much smaller in the bosons. And then what comes out of all of this, if you put in a little bit more interactions of a certain kind, would be very different. And I suspect that's what's giving this very complicated behavior at small doping. But I can't prove that from this calculation. Now, one issue yet to wonder about is why D-wave? The bosons themselves don't know anything about symmetry, right? They're S-wave. They can't know anything about any fancier symmetry. What we now need to look at is what happens if you're developing a pair wave function that has some extent to it, and how this pair wave function interacts with an underlying spin-spin correlation that's trying to drive the system antiferromagnetic. Eventually, out at large enough distance, these two symmetries are not going to get along with each other. It's only going to be locally where they can really cooperate. What I claim happens is that the D wave takes out magically a lot of misaligned spins. The nodes of the D wave are lined up with the antiferromagnet in such a way that if I were trying to make a spin singlet, I'm zapping a lot of potential spin triplet pair breaking contributions. There it is. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. Now, if I have a true antiferromagnetic long range order, I will still have pair breaking contributions even for the D wave case. They'll still be around, but they'll be reduced relative to S wave. So I still need to get the antiferromagnetic correlation length short enough so that these remaining pair breaking guys are not going to cause me any problems. The long range antiferromagnet still will not be a D-wave superconductor, but when I make the correlation length short enough, the superconducting fluctuations can win in this general competition of ordering.
So the dashed line is.
I just chose a size for the radius of the pair wave function. It's completely arbitrary. Well, if I put an upspin here and I want to make a spin singlet pair, it helps a lot if the antiferromagnetism is also trying to make a downspin, right? But if I have this antiferromagnetic pattern here and I'm looking at a larger pair wave function, not all the spins in the antiferromagnet will work. It just so happens that the nodes of the D-wave guy take out a collection of these such that I end up with roughly twice as many properly aligned spins as I do improperly aligned spins. That doesn't happen for the other symmetries.
There's a complication that Didier Oblong first looked at and Doug and I looked at when we When we looked in DMRG, we looked at a structure of real space and just used a hole projection operator for two holes to see where that was maximum. We found that it was actually maximum on the diagonal, even though the pairs we were seeing were D-wave. And it turned out that there was an interesting structure where you had two holes on the diagonal, but there was a singlet that appeared across the other diagonal. And it allowed the spin quantum numbers to come out right. And we looked at it in terms of a retardation effect, where you thought of a pair being like this and being like this, and to go through, they would put a singlet across it. So I've not seen that sort of physics.
Yeah, I'm not making that kind of argument, but we should definitely talk about that. I need to talk about this. What I claim is driving all of this stuff was this initial crossover in the entropy at rather high temperatures. Not infinite temperature, but still quite high temperatures. This crossover in the entropy is strongly density dependent. Right? These are functions of density. This is a plot of delta S. It falls really sharply as you increase the doping. Eventually, if this change in entropy is small enough, it can't do anything anymore in terms of driving any change in the degrees of freedom. In particular, if it gets small enough so that when you cool the system a little bit, the multi-site interactions, the hopping and the potential spin interactions, give you a larger gain in energy, this entropy change isn't going to matter. Where I see the pair fluctuations disappear is right around, make sure I get the right numbers here. Yeah, right around here.
See what is half filled.
Half filled is here.
Okay. See what is low.
So this is roughly where I see a real sharp crash in the pair fluctuations. And so there's a natural upper limit to the doping where the pair fluctuations appear. What happens in my series analysis is the series for the correlation length squared, all the terms in the series become negative. So that's a pretty strong indication that there's no correlation length. But it's limited right about here. And that's kind of where this entropy change has really decayed away, largely. What I would say is happening at very low doping, the pairing is losing to antiferromagnetism, which we know. At very high doping, the whole push for producing pairing goes away completely, and it's only at some intermediate range where pairing is possible.
You're basically saying the same thing as Phil Anderson has been emphasizing for a long time, right? If you know energy in outer space,
let me go.
It's a completely different world from the non-interacting system. Both of the projections, and of course, the enclosed hall filling, that it's way harder than when the system is nearly empty.
But there's one very different thing that I would say compared to the general idea of RVB as presented by...
I'm not saying RVB. Phil was making a stronger statement that the
conservationality
of building space is completely different from that of a non-contact Fermi gas.
Well, yeah, all obviously...
All change, you know, it's highly non-contributive effect you were doing.
Yeah, very much so. I would agree. His RVB idea was based on spin charge separation, but he was emphasizing a connection to 1D. And I've tried to not do that. I've put the spin charge separation at high temperatures. He doesn't have some sort of intermediate fluctuation, which is kind of my desire to get away from that. So, okay, we agree on that point. The big difference is that he has, as an intermediary, a spin liquid phase. And I haven't said anything about a spin liquid. For me, when the spins start becoming coherent, I'm going into the pair fluctuations already. Now, that might be a matter of semantics. I don't know. But I would argue that there is a very natural reason to have D-wave, whereas originally in the spin liquid approach, S-wave was the original idea, and it was Morris's calculations that showed it was D-wave.
That's what people are going.
Yeah. Well, but I think you did it first back in the 80s for the projected wave functions. So I would say that there's a little bit of difference maybe in motivation, but you kind of end up at roughly the same low temperature state, but the motivation is different. So I would argue that, yes, the pair fluctuations are there. And if I want to avoid going through a secondary step in how I get the pair fluctuations, I start at high temperatures with degrees of freedom, which are hardcore bosons and spin a half fermions. And these guys have a difference in energy scale of about a factor of five. Hardcore bosons are driving the pair formation, but it's the spin degrees of freedom that determine the symmetry, of course. When you get down to the spin coherence scale, you get the actual electronic fluctuations growing. That's it.